I'd like to start by saying that today represents a huge step change in the future of the New Zealand government. Today we have established the beginnings of a strong, proactive government. The majority of New Zealanders voted for change in this election. And from the beginning, we have both been committed to delivering that change. First, by undertaking a round of robust negotiations, and Mr. Peters, I thank you for the process that you set out and the strong foundation that it served to give us both as coalition partners. The second way we set out to deliver that change that New Zealanders voted for was through the agreements that have been signed today that build a clear agenda. You'll see from them that we have prioritised regional economic development and job creation for New Zealanders. There has been a period of neglect in the last 9 years for our regions. New Zealand First has brought enormous advocacy at the negotiating table to make sure that we see the beginnings of the reinvestment that is much needed in New Zealand. You'll see a reduction in inequalities, emphasis in the agreement with New Zealand First around investing in health, investing in education, and significant increases in the minimum wage. And finally, you'll see real progress on environmental issues, particularly water quality and climate change, which New Zealand First has also advocated for in these negotiations. Everything in this agreement sits within our budget responsibility rules. We are committed to a fiscally responsible government which grows the economy, but makes sure that everybody shares in its prosperity. I am proud to be in the position to soon lead a government committed to a better, fairer New Zealand. And I thank Mr. Peters and his team for the role that they have played in these negotiations in creating the foundation for that government. We're ready to take questions.
Are you both happy with what you've had to trade away or give up on this agreement?
My view is that we've built a strong foundation. In fact, the agreement enhances certainly some of our policy positions, and so I'm absolutely comfortable with where we've landed.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, we're never going to get everything we wanted. We knew that from the start. Politics has been always an issue of compromise, but principles as well, and we have got a balance on both that our team in New Zealand First is entirely happy with, and we're grateful to the Labour Party for understanding that and for reaching the agreement we've got.
Looking at the priority placed by the incoming government on the regions, how will the $1 billion a year regional investment fund be administered, and what sort of projects will it go to?
Well, that comes from the $10 billion of unallocated capital spending that we've set out in our fiscal plan across 4 years. So that's where that fund comes from. It will be a combination of investment in, for instance, regional rail, heavy investment in forestry. There will also be opportunities where, for instance, we may find projects that could, for instance, take on infrastructure bonds in order to fund them. Essentially, what we're saying as a government is we are committed to making sure we rebuild our regions, that there is strong growth and that there are job opportunities that have been neglected for too long. That is why this fund has been created. Infrastructure, rail, roading, job opportunities, health, education, you name it, and we'll find an example of these being neglected. Oh, look, I'd say there's been real advocacy from Mr. Peters, particularly around Northland. But again, there's obvious reasons why that's been the case. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a region that hasn't experienced neglect.
Mr. Peters, will rail to Northport be one of the first new rail initiatives addressed by the fund? Will rail from Northland to Northport be part of that?
Well, you know, I think it's very clear that the two parties in this coalition and this coalition agreement understand that when the head of Main Freight says it's a no-brainer, that it may just be a no-brainer. And with respect to the last question, when the mayor of the Median is screaming out this morning for infrastructural investment, I kind of think it's happening in a lot of parts of the country.
Mr. Peters, why have you sought a Walker jumping
bill? Pardon?
Why are you asking for a Walker jumping bill?
Well, we thought it was a brilliant idea on Leopard's part in 1999, and we still think so.
But what? Why are you worried that someone wouldn't be trying to jump?
No. We always thought it was a brilliant idea in 1999. We couldn't understand the sunset clause that they put in it, because the veracity and integrity behind the system is that we go to the wire, Labor and Human First Party, in terms of our workforce out there and branches all over the country, to put members of Parliament to Parliament, and they need to act responsibly and remember who put them there. It's not a matter of being anti-democratic, but we've had too many examples, and over a long period of time, probably I can list you about 27 members plus who decided that it was what they had created, not what the party had created for them. So it's a matter of honouring the support mechanisms that make us put us here first, and then alongside that, the electorate that voted for us. And we give them a chance. If you're a list member, then that's it. But if you're a constituency member, we'll put it back to the electorate. And I know something personally about doing that, in terms of walking out, resigning, and putting it to the electorate to gain a mandate. So I'm not preaching some sort of philosophy here, I'm preaching some practical thing that I believe in.
Why have you not put any numbers on the immigration policy in terms of target for next to both?
On the website, we referenced our mutual agreement around the policy which Labor took to the election. We had a conversation which demonstrated we shared the concern of exploitation, particularly in our export education sector, the need to strengthen those labour market tests. We've referenced that policy in the agreement, and of course that policy came with an estimate of the reduction in net migration it would bring. So that's entirely consistent with our policy, nothing in that regard has changed.
But would that go far enough for New Zealand First, Mr. Peters, who had a much lower target for migrant numbers?
Look, I accept that, but we're into negotiations sincerely to try and get a resolution, and we're happy to accept the resolution the way that our party has framed it. And it just so happens that there's an enormous amount of public controversy about those two issues right now, carried by you in the media and carried by experts. So maybe it will work out.
What's the cost of your policies, Mr.
We've got individual costings for a number of them, but is there a specific one you'd like a price on, Audrey?
All of them.
Well, for instance, we've costed some of the individual ones around breast screening, around the additional doctor's visits. All of those, however, come out of the $8 billion of additional funding that we've put aside for the health budget. Likewise, for everything that relates to education spending. For the additional investment in policing, we're looking at a total figure of $100 million to make sure that we bring that 1,800 additional police on stream. That's, of course, we already budgeted for an extra 1,000 police, so that is just an additional $40 million required to bring to pass that coalition agreement.
So while the fiscal responsibility for the Green Party, are you saying that this will...
Of course, the budget responsibility rules apply to us regardless of how we're, in the sense of how we are rolling out our agenda. And so we have made sure that we have complied with the budget responsibility rules in this agreement.
So do you have a figure then for what the policies with New Zealand First and the Greens cost over and above what you have already costed for in your alternative budget?
Yes, enough to know that of course we have stuck within our budget responsibility rules. A number of the agreements, as I say, come out of baselines. Some will be from reprioritisation. Some come from CapEx, where we've demonstrated that we already have additional funding available. We do, however, want to make sure that we go through the process of precisely costing each policy. We, from opposition at the time of negotiation, have been able to put numbers on most of these policies, but we want to make sure before we put out numbers that they are robust, and we'll be using the state sector and the civil service to do that.
So you don't have a...
Could I just say, Prime Minister, a number of the policies in this agreement totally between two parties that agreed before we started. So in terms of marrying the two policies together and try to realise the costing, it's not possible. It'll be the cost of this new government with policies that both parties share in many cases.
Just looking at the minimum wage rise to $20 by 2020 and coming forward. plan. Will that be legislated in one go, i.e.
In our first 100 days, the first change that will be legislated is $16.50 starting in April 2018. From then, we will use our discretion as government to ensure that the step changes are done at an appropriate time in an appropriate way. We're not legislating now the timetable for the introduction, but we've been very clear on the goal and where we see ourselves finishing in 2020 with introduction by 2021. And as Mr. Peters has made the point continually in our talks, and we absolutely agree, we are a low-wage economy. New Zealanders deserve to have a wage that they can live on, that they can survive on, that they can have a quality of life with. What we're saying today is that it's no longer acceptable to try and expect families to survive on the minimum wage at the level that it is.
What changes have you made to the Foreign Ownership Act? And in particular, are you going to ban foreign buying of residential properties?
Absolutely. We have agreement on banning the purchase of existing homes by foreign buyers. We also have plans around farmland and other critical infrastructure. That's also already been our existing policy. And I believe we also share a common view on cutting rights in the forestry industry. Those are some areas where we'll be looking to tighten up legislation.
So when you say plans around farmland and other infrastructure, what are those plans?
For instance, using the OIO for sales of 5 hectares or more, for instance.
Mr. Peters, you wanted to ban foreign buying of land right across the board. Why didn't you manage to get that in your agreement?
I got pretty close. Then near enough. And the reality is there's going to be a change and a clear signal sent internationally that New Zealand is no longer for sale in the way it has been. And we're happy with that.
And could this be done through a stamp duty rather than a ban itself?
Well, we've set out clearly what our expectation is. We share the goal that we will make sure New Zealanders have the ability to buy a home, a decent, dry, affordable home in New Zealand. One of the steps towards that is making sure that we deal with some of the demand, and that means clamping down on foreign buyers' ability to buy in our existing housing market. We will find the mechanism in order to deliver that goal. And we've talked about some of the mechanisms that we've been pursuing before the election, but our goal and our commitment is to ban foreign buyers from buying in the existing housing market.
But could that mechanism include a stamp duty? You seem not to be very clear on a ban or a stamp duty. You're saying it could be a stamp
duty. We will stop foreign buyers from buying homes in our existing housing market.
It's not a foreign buyer.
Yes, non-resident foreign
buyers. Can I just say, look, we do in these negotiations, despite what we've written down, we have a future intention for flexibility to work our way through these issues. We've written it to our agreement. But I might add that the structure and strategy that you advocate did not work in Vancouver and has not worked in other parts of the world. And we would like to put some intelligent science into it before, I think, we discuss that together.
So what form of ban or mechanism would you like to see?
Well, the Prime Minister's outlined all of the ban, but if you've got a better way, I mean, we're not against getting more income from the state, but when you realise that that won't stop what's going on and didn't stop them in Vancouver and other parts of the world, then maybe that strategy would be favourable. I think we're flexible to the future, but how we handle it.
Can I get some clarification on the sale of farmland issue? Aside from making the test 5 hectares or more, are there plans to legislate something so that the Overseas Investment Office applies a stricter test to foreign buying land?
They're not applying their current tests, almost at all. Our view was that, yes, we should be making sure that at 5 hectares or more that is going through the OIO, that is our starting point, but also making sure that they're actually fulfilling the obligations they have now, which they are not.
So will there be a
Yes, we have been looking at changing the objectives set out in the Reserve Bank Act. We've actually committed to a review more broadly. And so that includes, for instance, having the Governor consult more broadly with the board, changing the membership of the board. We're open to a review, but again, the objectives of the Act to possibly include employment is certainly part of our plans.
Can you talk a bit more about the defence plans and the review of that major procurement budget that the National Party has set out, and what does that
mean? Well, if you've seen the defence capability plan put out by the government, and you've seen what its budget is, but our concern is that there has been so much in the recent history of procurement which is highly suspect. 104 labs freezed out of Canada, for example, that never saw more than 42 crewed, and the remainder were explained away to the politicians and the people of this country as being spares. It's that sort of bind we wish to seriously examine and to see whether we can do far better for the same budget.
But is that budget potentially going to be scaled back, or are you signalling a change in the approach to the procurement? Because some of that's already underway.
It always is underway.
Yeah, but the start of that particular capability plan, some of the spending is already underway. And I'm just wondering whether you're committing to that 20 billion, or whether that will be actually scaled back in any way.
Yeah, we're sticking within the parameters of what's already been set out within the capability review, within the context of the capability review, this work will be happening. But as Mr. Peters has said, we want to make sure that we don't simply inherit poor practice when it comes to procurement.
This is something you'll recall with President Trump, what you guys talked about and how long that took
last? It was roughly a 5-minute call. It focused almost entirely on the New Zealand election. I'm told it had quite a bit of coverage in Washington and on the East Coast. So he was interested to talk briefly about that. I made reference to New Zealand's role in relationships in Asia Pacific, how important that was to us, and that I look forward to discussing our priorities in the future when we have the potential to meet at APEC.
Was your discussion visiting the country?
No discussion of that nature did not occur.
What's the New Zealand's relationship with this guy?
Of course, our relationship with the US is incredibly important. That has not changed, and it will not change.
What is your view on taking...
Sorry, Jane, Andrew. You'll see from the agreement before you that New Zealand First and Labor are absolutely committed to New Zealand taking seriously the challenges of climate change. It includes a reference to introducing a Zero Carbon Act and an independent climate commission, as set out by the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment. And I think it's fair to say both parties took very seriously the work that was presented by the Commissioner. It's also fair to say that New Zealand First made strong representations around the transition that some sectors, particularly the agriculture sector, will face as we progress towards our targets. They advocated for greater support for the agricultural sector. We advocated for the need to make sure that the Climate Commission were able to bring in agriculture if and when they saw fit. The compromise we reached is that the Climate Commission will have that ability, the ability to make us world leaders when it comes to taking into account our agricultural emissions, but we will make sure that we shoulder a bit more of the burden that the agricultural sector will face as a result. And that's as a result of New Zealand First advocacy. That would be a decision for the Independent Climate Commission as part of the carbon budgeting work they'll do. Oh, look, at this present point in time, there's no point talking about that. We're in very, very early stages. I want to make sure that the message that our agricultural sector hears is that the government will be making sure they burden a significant part of the cost. Only if we are able to find a satisfactory resolution to the current legislation, and if only we are able to find agreement between our support parties.
Well, as the Prime Minister said, contrary to what I've been reading, we have an agreement that the matter sits there until we can resolve it satisfactorily between ourselves, including all the partners, parties and interests that are involved.
Mm.
Well, we didn't discuss that because that may not include that at all, and that would be something that the government, the previous government, was warned about by New Zealand First an awful long time ago, and they utterly ignored us. Then turned up with a bill saying, would you support us backtracking or reneging on our commitments? Mm-hmm. We've taken a principled stand here, and with both parties, and I believe it's a way through to the future.
That's not what's come up, you know. At this point, it's our job to see if we are able, through our best endeavours, to find a resolution that is satisfactory to everyone. As Mr. Peters said, we're not wanting to preempt that process.
Can I hear from you both about your position on TPP as we come up to a deadline at APEC and the position this government intends to take into the Trade Minister and Leaders meeting in terms of New Zealand's position?
Oh, I found a huge amount of consensus actually in talks with New Zealand First around our position on TPP and TPP 11. And that consensus particularly sits around our view on banning foreign overseas buyers from purchasing existing homes, and also ongoing concerns with ISDS clauses. We'll go into negotiations with that view in mind. Of course, we don't want to undermine our negotiating position, but it was very clear from the talks that we have the same concerns, but at the same time, we both support increasing exports and export growth for New Zealand and representing those who are exporting to the best of our ability in these negotiations.
Will you walk away from the deal if you're not able to get those
concerns? I'm not undermining our negotiating position by answering that question.
This is a question for you on the foreign affairs portfolio in New Zealand as the foreign affairs and the unexpected position. Now, specifically in May, when we were traveling to Australia, you said that he should apologise for allowing New Zealand to be a stepping stone for people entering Australia. Will you do that?
Well, first of all, the Prime Minister will announce tomorrow who's getting what job. And I'm not going to circumvent her right to do that. She's in the privileged position. And with all the pressure of undertaking to do that, and I'm not going to answer your question today for that reason.
Yeah, what's the price of the gold card? It's on the issue of the gold card, which has been enhanced, the super gold card. How much is that going to cost? You could just expand a little bit on what that
Well, we factored that it would cost somewhere between 6 and 8 million when we announced the super smart gold card. And I think Labor has got a higher calculation, maybe whatever it is, it's not high, given that this card will be held by 687,000 plus and be one super smart card for a whole lot of things to do with their health and medicine, drugstores, the 400 yards. So it is bringing up to date and giving them something, a utility, which they can use for far wider range of things, including consumer buying and banking. That's the name of it. It'll be a modernised, right up to date card, latest thing that we could possibly bring out, and I regret that the last couple of weeks of 9 years of apathy towards it.
And well, I should add that we will be adding a free annual doctor's visit to the holders of those cards. We've estimated the cost of that to be at about $16 million. Keeping in mind, of course, that there are flow-on benefits to all of us if we invest in decent healthcare for our seniors.
Mr. Peters,
I know you've been waiting.
What's the process now, the timeframe on the referendum in Asia?
On the
referendum, I guess, in Asia?
That reference in the agreement is around an SOP, which would just be introduced at the House at the same time as SOPs are for bills.
Right, so that's in terms of the end of life choice bill from here. Is that kind of Mr. Peters' slight at David Seymour?
Well, it's a private member's bill, right? And so the speed or recognition to the House is over to the system itself. That's all we've asked for. And if they were a reasonable person, could possibly vote. All we've asked for is have a referendum option in as an SOP to ask the public of this country. Yeah. That's what we're asking for.
No, sir, can I ask you about the United Nations, the resolution 2334? Mm. Why have you agreed to a minute about that when
You'll see that that point in the agreement isn't a reference to the nature of the resolution. It's simply a reference to the process. We could not dispute that the process did not come back to a full cabinet discussion or agreement before it was put before the UN under our leadership there. That's indisputable. Our view is that for significant issues, of course you would and should, under normal circumstances, involve the executive in that decision. So that point for us is not about disputing the resolution, but the process the resolution went through. I believe that there was the ability for the process to have been built in had the work been done earlier, and the work should have been done earlier.
Just one thing. The Cabinet Manual on denunciation resolutions of that kind demands, not optional, it's not voluntary, demands it come before Cabinet. That's what we're saying. Mm. We don't want to be a third world government. We should be following first world processes.
Yeah. And there would have been the ability to bring Cabinet together if required.
Yes.
Yes. Employment and price stability will be part of the review. Reopen negotiations.
Well, the reality is we were going, according to the previous government, bust us until one day, apparently on the golf course of Hawaii, we decided to stop. No public statement, no announcement, that's it. Before that, go and look at all the press statements put out by Mr. Grosso. We want to know why that happened, why we've got the second biggest meat and dairy import in the world, and we're boycotting trade with them. Well, the consequence of that, of course, of that sort of behaviour, is that you still require a public statement, surely, from a government that's first world. And the second thing is, whereupon the European Union, who said, thank you very much, New Zealand, then started invading our export markets. That's the gratitude they exhibited towards what we were doing. But I don't want to take this too far. I'm just trying to explain. Here comes a glorious opportunity to put ourselves into a trading market with Belarus and Kazakhstan and Russia, and give ourselves an opportunity to deal with the second biggest beef and dairy import in the world. And it's not a case, as it was said by the previous Prime Minister, but one, that we stopped because they broke. That's not true. As soon as the Prime Minister sees maybe how Putin will Lavrov.
And also, of course, we do have the small matter of getting through a swearing-in ceremony, a first induction of Cabinet, and then a first Cabinet meeting. Rest assured, we'll be endeavouring to do that within the next 5 days. But look, I appreciate the opportunity to have showcased Mr. Peter's extensive knowledge and expertise in the foreign affairs realm, not that I'm hinting at anything. But look, we'll wrap that for now. Thank you, everyone.